The Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Legend by Marie Lu, read by Stephen Kaplan and Marielle Stern. Los Angeles, California, Republic of America. Population 20,174,282. Part 1. The Boy Who Walks in the Light. Day. My mother thinks I'm dead. Obviously, I'm not dead, but it's safer for her to think so. At least twice a month, I see my wanted poster flashed on the Jumbotron scattered throughout downtown Los Angeles. It looks out of place up there. Most of the pictures on the screen are of happy things. Smiling children standing under a bright blue sky. Tourists posing before the Golden Gate ruins. Republic commercials in neon colors. There's also anti-colonies propaganda. "The colonies want our land," the ads declare. "They want what they don't have. Don't let them conquer your homes. Support the cause." Then there's my criminal report. It lights up the Jumbotrons in all its multicolored glory. Wanted by the Republic. File number 462178-3233. Day. Wanted for assault, arson, theft, destruction of military property, and hindering the war effort. 200,000 Republic notes for information leading to arrest. They always have a different photo running alongside the report. One time it was a boy with glasses and a head full of thick copper curls. Another time it was a boy with black eyes and no hair at all. Sometimes I'm black, sometimes white, sometimes olive or brown or yellow or red or whatever else they can think of. In other words, the Republic has no idea what I look like. They don't seem to know much of anything about me, except that I'm young and that when they run my fingerprints, they don't find a match in their databases. That's why they hate me. Why I'm not the most dangerous criminal in the country, but the most wanted. I make them look bad. It's early evening, but it's already pitch black outside and the Jumbotron's reflections are visible in the street's puddles. I sit on a crumbling window ledge 3 stories up, hidden from view behind rusted steel beams. This used to be an apartment complex, but it's fallen into disrepair. Broken lanterns and glass shards litter the floor of this room, and paint is peeling from every wall. In one corner, an old portrait of the Elector Primo lies face up on the ground. I wonder who used to live here. No one's cracked enough to let their portrait of the Elector sit discarded on the floor like that. My hair, as usual, is tucked inside an old newsboy cap. My eyes are fixed on the small 1-story house across the road. My hands fiddle with the pendant tied around my neck. Tess leans against the room's other window, watching me closely. I'm restless tonight, and as always, she can sense it. The plague has hit the Lake Sector hard. In the glow of the Jumbotrons, Tess and I can see the soldiers at the end of the street as they inspect each home, their black capes shiny and worn loose in the heat. Each of them wears a gas mask. Sometimes when they emerge, they mark a house by painting a big red X on the front door. No one enters or leaves the home after that. At least not when anyone's looking.
"Still don't see them?"
Tess whispers. Shadows conceal her expression. In an attempt to distract myself, I'm piecing together a makeshift slingshot out of old PVC pipes.
"They haven't eaten dinner. They haven't sat down by the table in hours."
I shift and stretch out my bad knee.
"Maybe they're not home?"
I shoot Tess an irritated glance. She's trying to console me, but I'm not in the mood.
"A lamp's lit. Look at those candles. Mom would never waste candles if no one was home."
Tess moves closer.
"We should leave the city for a couple of weeks, yeah?"
She tries to keep her voice calm, but the fear is there.
"Soon the plague will have blown through, and you can come back to visit. We have more than enough money for 2 train tickets.
I shake my head.
"One night a week, remember? Just let me check up on them 1 night a week.
"Yeah.
You've been coming here every night this week."
"I just want to make sure they're okay."
"What if you get sick?"
"I'll take my chances. And you didn't have to come here with me. You could have waited for me back in Alta." Tess shrugs.
"Somebody has to keep an eye on you."
2 years younger than me, although sometimes she sounds old enough to be my caretaker. We look on in silence as the soldiers draw closer to my family's house.
Every time they stop at a home, one soldier pounds on the door while a second stands next to him with his gun drawn. If no one opens the door within 10 seconds, the first soldier kicks it in. I can't see them once they rush inside, but I know the drill. A soldier will draw a blood sample from each family member, then plug it into a handheld reader and check for the plague. The whole process takes 10 minutes. I count the houses between where the soldiers are now and where my family lives. I'll have to wait another hour before I know their fate. A shriek echoes from the other end of the street. My eyes dart toward the sound and my hand whips to the knife sheathed at my belt. Tess sucks in her breath. It's a plague victim. She must have been deteriorating for months because her skin is cracked and bleeding everywhere, and I find myself wondering how the soldiers could have missed this one during previous inspections. She stumbles around for a while, disoriented, then charges forward, only to trip and fall to her knees. I glance back toward the soldiers. They see her now. The soldier with the drawn weapon approaches, while the 11 others stay where they are and look on. One plague victim isn't much of a threat. The soldier lifts his gun and aims. A volley of sparks engulfs the infected woman. She collapses, then goes still. The soldier rejoins his comrades. I wish we could get our hands on one of the soldier's guns. A pretty weapon like that doesn't cost much on the market. 480 notes, less than a stove. Like all guns, it has precision, guided by magnets and electric currents, and can accurately shoot a target 3 blocks away. It's tech stolen from the colonies, Dad once said, although of course the Republic would never tell you that. Tess and I could buy 5 of them if we wanted. Over the years, we've learned to stockpile the extra money we steal and stash it away for emergencies. But the real problem with having a gun isn't the expense. It's that it's so easy to trace back to you. Each gun has a sensor on it that reports its user's hand shape, thumbprints, and location. If that didn't give me away, nothing would. So I'm left with my homemade weapons, PVC pipe slingshots, and other trinkets.
They found another one,
Tess says. She squints to get a better look. I look down and see the soldiers spill from another house. One of them shakes a can of spray and draws a giant red X on the door. I know that house. The family that lives there once had a little girl my age. My brothers and I played with her when we were younger. Freeze tag and street hockey with iron pokers and crumpled paper. Tess tries to distract me by nodding at the cloth bundle near my feet.
What did you bring them?
I smile, then reach down to untie the cloth. Some of the stuff we saved up this week. It'll make for a nice celebration once they pass the inspection. I dig through the little pile of goodies inside the bundle, then hold up a used pair of goggles. I check them again to make sure there are no cracks in the glass. For John, an early birthday gift. My older brother turns 19 later this week. He works 14-hour shifts in the neighborhood plant's friction stoves and always comes home rubbing his eyes from the smoke. These goggles were a lucky steal from a military supply shipment. I put them down and shuffle through the rest of the stuff. It's mostly tins of meat and potato hash I'd stolen from an airship's cafeteria and an old pair of shoes with intact soles. I wish I could be in the room with all of them when I deliver this stuff. But John's the only one who knows I'm alive, and he's promised not to tell Mom or Eden. Eden turns 10 in 2 months, which means that in 2 months he'll have to take the trial. I failed my own trial when I was 10. That's why I worry about Eden, because even though he's easily the smartest of us 3 boys, he thinks a lot like I do. When I finished my trial, I felt so sure of my answers that I didn't even bother to watch them grade it. But then the admins ushered me into a corner of the trial stadium with a bunch of other kids. They stamped something on my test and stuffed me onto a train headed downtown. I didn't get to take anything except the pendant I wore around my neck. I didn't even get to say goodbye. Several different things could happen after you take the trial. You get a perfect score, 1,500 points. No one's ever gotten this, well, except for some kid a few years ago who the military made a gaudy fuss over. Who knows what happens to someone with a score that high? Probably lots of money and power, yeah? You score between a 1450 and a 1499. Pat yourself on the back because you'll get instant access to 6 years of high school and then 4 at the top universities in the Republic. Drake, Stanford, and Brennan. Then Congress hires you and you make lots of money. Joy and happiness follow. At least according to the Republic. You get a good score, somewhere between 1250 and 1449 points. You get to continue on to high school and then you're assigned to a college. Not bad. You squeak by with a score between 1,000 and 1,249. Congress bars you from high school. You join the poor, like my family.
He'll probably either drown while working the water turbines or get steamed to death in the power plants. You fail. It's always the slum sector kids who fail. If you're in this unlucky category, the Republic sends officials to your family's home. They make your parents sign a contract giving the government full custody over you. They say you've been sent away to the Republic's labor camps and that your family will not see you again. Your parents have to nod and agree. A few even celebrate because the Republic gives them 1,000 notes as a condolence gift. Money and one less mouth to feed? What a thoughtful government. Except this is all a lie. An inferior child with bad genes is no use to the country. If you're lucky, Congress will let you die without first sending you to the labs to be examined for imperfections. 5 houses remain. Tess sees the worry in my eyes and puts a hand on my forehead.
One of your headaches coming on?
No, I'm okay. I peer in the open window at my mother's house, then catch my first glimpse of a familiar face. Eden walks by, then peeks out the window at the approaching soldiers and points some handmade metal contraption at them. Then he ducks back inside and disappears from view. His curls flash white blonde in the flickering lamplight. Knowing him, he probably built that gadget to measure how far away someone is, or something like that.
He looks thinner, I mutter. He's alive and walking around, Tess replies. I'd say that's a win.
Minutes later, we see John and my mother wander past the window, deep in conversation. John and I look pretty similar, although he's grown a little stockier from long days at the plant. His hair, like most who live in our sector, hangs down past his shoulders and is tied back into a simple tail. His vest is smudged with red clay. I can tell Mom's scolding him for something or other, probably for letting Eden peek out the window. She bats John's hand away when a bout of chronic coughing hits her. I let out a breath. So, at least all 3 of them are healthy enough to walk. Even if one of them is infected, it's early enough that they'll still have a chance to recover. I can't stop imagining what will happen if the soldiers mark my mother's door. My family will stand frozen in our living room long after the soldiers have left. Then Mom will put on her usual brave face, only to sit up through the night quietly wiping tears away. In the morning, they'll start receiving small rations of food and water and simply wait to recover. Or die. My mind wanders to the stash of stolen money that Tess and I have hidden. 2,500 notes. Enough to feed us for months, but not enough to buy my family vials of plague medicine. The minutes drag on. I tuck my slingshot away and play a few rounds of rock, paper, scissors with Tess. I don't know why, but she's crazy good at this game. I glance several times at my mother's window, but don't see anyone. They must have gathered near the door, ready to open it as soon as they hear a fist against the wood. And then the time comes. I lean forward on the ledge, so far that Tess grips my arm to make sure I don't topple to the ground. The soldiers pound on the door. My mother opens it immediately, lets the soldiers in, and then closes it. I strain to hear voices, footsteps, anything that might come from my house. The sooner this is all over, the sooner I can sneak my gifts to John. The silence drags on. Tess whispers,
"No news is good news, right?"
Very funny. I count off the seconds in my head. 1 minute passes, then 2, then 4, and then finally 10 minutes. Then 15 minutes, 20 minutes. I look at Tess. She just shrugs.
"Maybe their reader's broken," she suggests.
30 minutes pass. I don't dare move from my vigil. I'm afraid something will happen so quickly that I'll miss it if I blink. My fingers tap rhythmically against the hilt of my knife. 40 minutes. 50 minutes. An hour.
"Something's wrong," I whisper.
Tess purses her lips.
"You don't know that."
"Yes, I do. What could possibly take this long?" Tess opens her mouth to reply, but before she can say anything, the soldiers are exiting my house, single file, expressionless. Finally, the last soldier shuts the door behind him and reaches for something tucked at his waist. I suddenly feel dizzy. I know what's coming. The soldier reaches up and sprays one long red diagonal line on our door. Then he sprays another line, making an X. I curse silently under my breath and start to turn away. But then the soldier does something unexpected. Something I've never seen before. He sprays a third vertical line on my mother's door, cutting the X in half.
June. 1:47 p.m., Drake University, Batala Sector, 72 degrees Fahrenheit indoors. I'm sitting in my dean secretary's office, again. On the other side of the frosted glass door, I can see a bunch of my classmates, seniors, all at least 4 years older than me, hanging around in an attempt to hear what's going on. Several of them saw me being yanked out of our afternoon drill class. Today's lesson, how to load and unload the XM-621 rifle, by a menacing pair of guards. And whenever that happens, the news spreads all over campus. The Republic's favorite little prodigy is in trouble again. The office is quiet except for the faint hum coming from the dean secretary's computer. I've memorized every detail of this room. Hand-cut marble floors imported from Dakota, 324 plastic square ceiling tiles, 20 feet of gray drapes hanging to either side of the glorious elector's portrait on the office's back wall, a 30-inch screen on the side wall, with the sound muted and a headline that reads, "Traitorous Patriots Group Bombs Local Military Station, Kills 5," followed by, "Republic Defeats Colonies in Battle for Hillsborough." Arisna Whitaker, the dean's secretary herself, is seated behind her desk, tapping on its glass, no doubt typing up my report. This will be my 8th report this quarter. I'm willing to bet I'm the only Drake student who's ever managed to get 8 reports in one quarter without being expelled. "Injured your hand yesterday, Miss Whitaker?" I say after a while. She stops typing to glare at me. "What makes you think that, Miss Paris?" "The pauses in your keystrokes are off. You're favoring your left hand." Miss Whitaker sighs and leans back in her chair. "Yes, June. I twisted my wrist yesterday in a game of Kiva ball." "Sorry to hear it. You should try to swing more from your arm and not from your wrist." I'd meant this simply to be a statement of fact, but it sounded sort of taunting and doesn't seem to have made her any happier. "Let's get something straight, Miss Paris," she says. "You may think you're very smart. You may think your perfect grades earn you some sort of special treatment. You may even think you have fans at this school, what with all this nonsense." She gestures at the students gathered outside the door. "But I've grown incredibly tired of our get-togethers in my office. And believe me, when you graduate and get assigned to whatever post this country chooses for you, your antics won't impress your superiors there. Do you understand me?" I nod because that's what she wants me to do, but she's wrong. I don't just think I'm smart. I'm the only person in the entire Republic with a perfect 1500 score on her trial. I was assigned here, to the country's top university, at 12, 4 years ahead of schedule. Then I skipped my sophomore year. I've earned perfect grades at Drake for 3 years. I am smart. I have what the Republic considers good genes. And better genes make for better soldiers, make for better chance of victory against the colonies, my professors always say. And if I feel like my afternoon drills aren't teaching me enough about how to climb walls while carrying weapons, then, well, it wasn't my fault I had to scale the side of a 19-story building with an XM-621 gun strapped to my back. It was self-improvement for the sake of my country. Rumor has it that Day once scaled 5 stories in less than 8 seconds. If the Republic's most wanted criminal can pull that off, then how are we ever going to catch him if we're not just as fast? And if we can't even catch him, how are we going to win the war? Miss Whitaker's desk beeps 3 times. She holds down a button. "Yes?" "Captain Mateus Imparis is outside the gate," a voice replies. "He's here for his sister." "Good. Send him in." She releases the button and points a finger at me. "I hope that brother of yours starts doing a better job of minding you, because if you end up in my office one more time this quarter..." "Mateus is doing a better job than our dead parents," I reply, maybe more sharply than I intended. We fall into an uncomfortable silence. Finally, after what seems like an eternity, I hear a commotion out in the hall. The students pressed against the door's glass abruptly disperse, and their shadows move aside to make room for a tall silhouette, my brother. As Mateus opens the door and steps inside, I can see some girls out in the hall stifling smiles behind their hands. But Mateus fixes his full attention on me. We have the same eyes, black with a gold glint, the same long lashes and dark hair. The long lashes work particularly well for Mateus. Even with the door closed behind him, I can still hear the whispers and giggles from outside. It looks like he came from his patrol duties straight to my campus. He's decked out in his full uniform. Black officer coat with double rows of gold buttons, gloves, neoprene spectra lining, captain rank embroidery, shining epaulettes on his shoulders, formal military hat, black trousers, polished boots. My eyes meet his. He's furious. Miss Whittaker gives Mateus a brilliant smile. "Ah, Captain," she exclaims. "It's a pleasure to see you." Mateus taps on the edge of his hat in a polite salute. "It's unfortunate it's under these circumstances again," he replies. "My apologies." "Not a problem, Captain." The dean's secretary waves her hand dismissively. What a brown-noser, especially after what she just said about Mateus. "It's hardly your fault. Your sister was caught scaling a high-rise during her lunch hour today. She'd wandered 2 blocks off campus to do it. As you know, students are to use only the climbing walls on campus for physical training, and leaving the campus in the middle of the day is forbidden." "Yes, I'm aware of that," Mateus interrupts, looking at me out of the corner of his eye. "I saw the helicopters over Drake at noon and had a suspicion June might have been involved." There had been 3 helicopters. They couldn't get me off the side of the building by scaling it themselves, so they pulled me off with a net. "Thank you for your help," Mateus says to the dean's secretary. He snaps his fingers at me, my cue to get up. "When June returns to campus, she'll be on her best behavior." I ignore Miss Whittaker's false smile as I follow my brother out of the office and into the hall. Immediately, students hurry over. "June," a boy named Dorian says as he tags alongside us. He'd asked me, unsuccessfully, to the annual Drake Ball 2 years in a row. "Is it true? How high up did you get?" Mateus cuts him off with a stern look. "June's heading home." Then he puts a hand firmly on my shoulder and guides me away from my classmates. I glance behind me and manage a smile for them. 14 floors, I call back. That gets them buzzing again. Somehow this has become the closest relationship I have with the other Drake students. I am respected, discussed, gossiped about. Not really talked to. Such is the life of a 15-year-old senior in a university meant for 16 and up. Mateus doesn't say another word as we make our way down the corridors, past the manicured lawns of the central quad and the glorious Elector's statue, and finally through one of the indoor gyms. We pass by the afternoon drills I'm supposed to be participating in. I watch my classmates run along a giant track, surrounded by 360-degree screens simulating some desolate waterfront road. They're holding their rifles out in front of them, attempting to load and unload as fast as they can while running. At most other universities, there wouldn't be so many student soldiers, but at Drake, almost all of us are well on our way to career assignments in the Republic's military. A few